Putting a human face to the conflict in the Middle East. Today, Wednesday, July 2nd. This is The World. I'm Carol Hill, sitting in for Marco Werman. Anger and grief boil over in Jerusalem after the deaths of four young people.
I've never actually seen it quite this tense. It seems as though both sides are calling for revenge at levels they haven't called for since the Second Intifada.
Also today, Iraqis use a smartphone messaging app to get around internet shutdowns. Plus, we'll learn how fungi and other microbes might help feed the planet and pull up a chair for a taste of Syrian Jewish cuisine with tamarind.
When it's prepared properly, it should be like lip-smackingly. You're supposed to go like that. If you don't go like that, too much sugar and not enough tamarind.
Those stories after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict feels like it's on a perpetual simmer. Then comes a moment when things appear to boil over. We're at one of those moments now. It started with the discovery earlier this week of the bodies of three Israeli teenagers. They disappeared while hitchhiking in the West Bank a few weeks ago. Then today, the body of a Palestinian teenager was discovered in the Jerusalem forest. Israeli police suspect he was abducted and murdered as an act of revenge. We've got Shira Frankel on the line from Jerusalem. She's the Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. And Shira, there's something that seems just so personal about these killings that we don't always feel as outside observers. I mean, we're talking about four teenage boys. What does it feel like there today?
I've never actually seen it quite this tense, at least in the 8 years or so that I've been here. It seems as though both sides are calling for revenge at levels that, as far as we know, they haven't called for since the Second Intifada. Already today, there were talks of this is already the Third Intifada. What you're witnessing is the beginning of this. And there's no sign that this violence is abating anytime soon.
In this conflict, in these just tragic episodes, the personal quickly turns political. I mean, we have Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blaming Hamas for the murder of the three Israeli teens. We've got Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas blaming Israel for the murder of the Palestinian teenager. I'm curious, does the Israeli and Palestinian public, do they latch onto those views too?
Yeah, very much so. Everything that gets said by political officials, whether they be Israeli or Palestinian, is then echoed back in the public. What we've had for the last 2 weeks is a lot of calls for revenge by Israel's political leadership. The kidnapping of the teenagers and the more than 2 weeks that it took to find their bodies led to 2 weeks of simmering tensions that boiled over when, in fact, it was discovered that not only had they been killed, they'd been killed in a fairly brutal way just minutes after getting into a car close to the Palestinian city of Hebron. So you had 2 weeks in which tensions could build and build, and the rhetoric by politicians during those 2 weeks were building as well. And what we're seeing now, I think, is a lot of it is the spillover from all of that.
Are there also calls in Israel for kind of calm, for sort of stepping back a bit, taking a breath?
Certainly, especially today. I think this morning with the death of a Palestinian teenager in East Jerusalem, you did hear more Israeli politicians saying, okay, now is the time for us all to step back and take a breather and let tensions sort of soothe themselves a bit. Unfortunately, those calls might be a little too little too late. We've seen, as I said, over 2 weeks, so much of an escalation in rhetoric that I think it'll take quite some time for those soothing words to actually make an impact.
What does all this mean for the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas?
Today we heard him calling for the killers of the young Palestinian teen to be brought to justice. He made the point that no person's blood is less sacred than another's. He's also called for tensions to be lowered. He said to Palestinian kids that to stay off the street, that throwing rocks and that engaging in sort of acts of violence is not going to gain them anything. But his voice is not really well heard at this point. He, for some time now, hasn't had a great deal of political sway behind him. And I think now is another example of his voice is just one among very many.
Shira, I understand you saw an attack yourself today. What happened?
Today, as I was leaving Shuafat, which is the epicenter of a lot of these clashes, I pulled into a gas station. And at first, it looked like the car in front of me was having some sort of altercation with the gas attendant. And then I realized suddenly that it was more than an altercation, that they had gotten out of the car and that they were hitting them and pulling this Palestinian gas attendant towards the street. They then yelled at me to get away and made some threatening comments. And it wasn't until later that another car showed up and managed to chase them away that I was able to speak to this Palestinian gas attendant and found out from him that not only had he been sort of brutalized before, and that earlier in that day, other cars that had come in had said things to him along the lines of, oh, you're a Palestinian, all Palestinian are terrorists, and hey, what are you doing here? Get out of here. This is our land. That this was, you know, to him, the moment that they attacked him, he feared for his life. And to me, it was sort of a stark example of one of many scenes that are playing out across Jerusalem. Police said that there were over 40 cases that they were called to of clashes between, small clashes between Israelis and Palestinians, and that in most cases, they couldn't even make it to the scene.
Shira Frankel is the Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. Shira, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Carol.
Look at Mideast headlines these days, and you might just see a dark cloud hanging over the next generation. Historian Juan Cole sees something else.
There's a generation here which is very different from its parents.
In Cole's latest book, The New Arabs, he argues that millennials in the Mideast are a new breed. He says they're more cosmopolitan, more urban, more literate, more wired, and less religiously observant than their parents. He offered one 30-something Tunisian activist as an example.
Amira Yahyaoui is a very serious young woman. She wears dark glasses and she is a voracious reader. She'll read existentialist literature by Eastern European writers exiled to Paris in the 1960s. She'll read medieval and early modern thought. And she formed an organization, Al-Bawsala, which monitored the drafting of the new constitution after the revolution and looked at the position of women in it and civil liberties and just kept the pressure on the members of the Constituent Assembly to observe international human rights norms with some great success.
And she's not unusual in this respect, is she?
She's particularly courageous and outspoken, but her values are widely shared in her generation.
So it sounds like Amira has hung in. She's accomplished a lot. But for the most part, the youth movements you write about in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, they were pretty good at tossing out dictators, but they've been pretty bad at constructing a stable government or in the sort of dirty business of actually creating policy or making stuff happen. What's happened there?
I think it's an unrealistic expectation that 22-year-olds and 25-year-olds would construct a government. In most of these countries, they're not old enough to stand for office. So the baby boomers, the people in their 60s, have had a huge food fight in the aftermath of the revolution. And the youth have been fairly disgusted by this. And
But wouldn't you think that would motivate the youth, the millennials, to sort of start organizing, start developing political parties, try to extend the sort of secular view that they were so passionate about? That's just not happening.
I think over time they will. And they're really not into political parties so much there as they are into networking. They're more sort of horizontal kind of relationships, using the internet to get ideas out. But where they are very, very dissatisfied with how politics have worked out, they do take to the streets again. And, you know, Egypt had a second youth revolution in 2013 against the Muslim Brotherhood.
What I think I'm struggling with is the young people that you talk about, the millennials. I mean, what makes them an important social movement if practically they're not really effective at this point? I mean, they can talk to each other and everybody's online and everybody can sort of communicate and have big thoughts. But if you can't organize and you can't really make stuff happen at the political level, what's the use?
Well, they will get older and they will become old enough to run for parliament. And it's 20 and 30 years before they come to head governments. But in the meantime, they're working for minority rights, for women's rights, for gay rights, for rights of people who don't believe in God. they're very courageous, and some of them have been put into jail in the last year because of these activities. They're not going anyplace, and their impact is much deeper than surface politics, and they will also emerge into surface politics as they get older.
Juan Cole is a professor of history at the University of Michigan. His latest book is called The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Thanks, Juan.
Thank you.
What do you think motivates the next generation of Arab activists? Put your questions to Juan Cole. He'll be joining us for a live Q&A on our Facebook page tonight at 8 Eastern Time. Just go to facebook.com/PRI the world. Now, you won't find much of a Jewish population anymore in Syria, but there is a Syrian Jewish diaspora in Brooklyn, New Jersey, and Israel, among other places. And many stay connected to their heritage through their traditional cuisine. Pupa Dweck has spent years documenting and perfecting the recipes of her Syrian Jewish community. She's the author of the cookbook Aromas of Aleppo. She recently spoke with producer Emma Morgenstern about a flavor that's distinctive to Syrian cooking, tamarind.
For many, tamarind is a new ingredient, and actually we call it the sour secret of Syrian cooking. It's a fruit that comes in a pod. It's from a tamarindo tree, actually. And the influence came from India via Persia to the city of Aleppo. The rest of the Middle East did not bring tamarind into their cuisine in the same way that Aleppo did. And oud, that's how it's pronounced in Arabic, is one of the most distinguishing flavors of the Aleppian cooking. When it's prepared properly, it should be like lip-smackingly. You're supposed to go like that. If you don't go like that, too much sugar and not enough tamarind. When it's right off the tree, you could see this hard pod. And then when I break it open, you see this date-like meat. You'll see threads and pits and different elements that we make sure to get just the actual taste of it. So what happens is that the tamarind gets soaked in water. We pull it apart, and then we're going to be pressing down on the tamarind that has been soaking till we could get the juice that is coming out of it. Then we're going to add sour salt, fresh lemon juice, and sugar, and then it gets cooked down. You need to visit with it and stay with it. You can't just put it up and leave the house. You know, it's your day. The custom is right before Passover, the women prepare between 30 and 40 pounds of tamarind for the year. And then some women will say, oh, I'm using my last of my tamarind. Pesach is coming. And then they make another batch. Tamarind is used in sweet meats like lechem ajin, the minced meat pies that everybody loves and that are all over the Middle East. It's also used in mehshis. Mehshis are stuffed vegetables. Anything that could get scooped out and stuffed was stuffed, even apricots. My mother was very patient, and she taught me everything. And she talked me through every dish. One of her specialties was apricot candy. And it would dry. It would be apricots that were steamed and mixed with roasted pistachios and then put on a tray, and it dried on her dining room credenza for weeks, and then we'd cut it. And every time I would ask her for the recipe, she'd call me up and tell me, it's done. I prepared it for you. It was the one recipe that I just couldn't get from her. The day before she passed away, she gave it to me.
And we have her mother's special recipe for apricot candy on our website, PRI.org. Pupa Dweck told her story to producer Emma Morgenstern. You can hear a longer version of the story on Vox Tablet, the weekly podcast of Tablet Magazine. This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. You've been hearing a lot about climate change on our program recently. That's because what we're doing to our atmosphere and our weather is essentially cooking up problems the likes of which we've never had to deal with before. Combine that with a booming human population, and you've got big challenges ahead. One of them is how to keep feeding all those people. The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson, is here to talk about a development that might help. Peter, I understand it has to do with microbes, and I want to know what microbes have to do with climate change and feeding the world, but remind us, what is a microbe?
Well, microbes are lots of things. Basically, they are organisms that are too small to see with the naked eye. They include bacteria and fungi. We're going to need a whole lot of new tools to help keep feeding 8, 9 billion people over the next several decades. And we're going to have to do it in a world of generally much warmer temperatures, a lot more rain in some places, a lot less rain in other places. And we have to do it without repeating the problems of the past, like pollution from pesticides and synthetic fertilizers.
So I'm assuming that we're not going to eat microbes off a plate, but that they're going to be used in somehow to improve or expand the food supply.
Well, we already do eat microbes. We just don't see them. They're everywhere. But in this case, we're talking about using microbes to help grow food more sustainably and more productively. We sent reporter Cynthia Graber out to talk with folks who are working in particular with fungi to help solve some of the problems that climate change is starting to throw at agriculture. So here's her report.
Stick a shovel in the ground and you'll dig up some soil, maybe a few little rocks, and of course some roots. Now, if you could take those roots inside for a closer look, you'd probably see something else as well.
When you hold this thing up to the light, what you can see is little tiny filaments, like little tiny strands of cotton, coming out from the roots, and that's the fungus.
Ian Sanders is a geneticist at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland, and he's obsessed with fungi. In particular, a type of fungi that live on the roots of about 80% of plants on the planet.
They help plants to grow.
Their tiny filaments help draw water and nutrients to the plant. In return, the plants feed sugars to the fungi. It's a symbiotic relationship that Sanders says is incredibly important.
Almost all our food plants naturally form this association with these fungi.
And those species of fungi aren't alone. There are thousands, maybe millions, of kinds of fungi, bacteria, and other microbes that help plants in a variety of ways. But their role has been almost invisible to people. And critics say modern agriculture actively works against it.
What we've done over the last 100 years in agriculture is to try to take microorganisms out of the picture.
That's Rusty Rodriguez, a microbiologist in Seattle.
And by doing that, by disrupting soil with tillage, by using chemical pesticides, we have greatly altered the agricultural microbiome.
Rodriguez is also obsessed with fungi. And like Ian Sanders, he wants to re-alter the agricultural microbiome. They're both part of a growing field of researchers and entrepreneurs working to bring microorganisms like fungi back into the agricultural mix, but in a new and targeted way. Sanders is breeding new varieties in the lab. Rodriguez's company gathers fungi from extreme environments all over the U.S. and cultivates them in their lab and greenhouse.
Quite a bit of tomato and soybean, corn, growing in different stages and for different types of experiments.
Rodriguez hopes the microbes he's working with here will help crops like these survive growing climate stresses like droughts and floods and extreme heat and cold. He's working with different kinds of fungi than Sanders is. But his goal is the same, to find and develop microbes that make agriculture more productive and more sustainable. Rodriguez plans to release his first two products this year. Sanders' work isn't quite ready for prime time. His first fungi field tests are being done in a lush tropical floodplain in Colombia.
This is cassava.
Colombia is the home of cassava. It's a root crop that's staple for more than a billion people. Sanders and a group of Colombian researchers set up experimental plots here. First, they grew cassava using a new fungal gel. Sanders says they had two goals.
Significant yield increases and hopefully significant reduction in fertilizer use at the same time.
A year later, when they harvested their first crop,
we were absolutely delighted.
Sanders says the plants grew up to 20% more roots. But he says that was just the beginning. The team has since grown cassava with different varieties of fungi Sanders bred in the lab. And he says so far they've had an even more dramatic impact on the plant's growth. Rusty Rodriguez in Seattle shares Sanders' bullish view of the future of agricultural fungi and bacteria.
I think that biologics are the next paradigm for agriculture.
Of course, we've heard talk like that before. Think synthetic fertilizers, chemical pesticides, and genetically modified crops. They all brought big initial benefits, but also big environmental concerns. So far, there hasn't been much pushback on biologics from environmentalists. But just because something's natural doesn't mean it's safe. So both Sanders and Rodriguez say they're working to make sure the fungi they're developing won't bring any unwanted impacts.
You have to know the organism's safe. I never want to be in a situation where I stand up in front of an audience and they ask me that question and I say, I don't know.
What Rodriguez does know is that lots of tools will be needed to help produce more food more sustainably. And Ian Sanders says we've been standing on some of those tools all along.
Sometimes people imagine that you have to go to unexplored wilderness to find something completely new, but we just have to look in the soil that's below our feet.
For The World, I'm Cynthia Graber.
Okay, our environment editor Peter Thompson is still with us. And Peter, what's your take on this kind of research into agricultural microbes?
Well, I think it has a lot of promise, but like Cynthia said, we've been down similar roads before in terms of sort of promised miracle fixes. So I think as a global society, we've got to be really careful. I'd actually love to hear what our listeners think. So I want to encourage folks to go to our website, that's PRI.org, click on the page for this story and leave your comments at the bottom. Is this something we should pursue? Give us a shout, PRI.org.
The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Carol.
Aswati Thirunal Ramavarma is probably not a name that rolls off the tip of your tongue, but Prince Ramavarma, as he's known, is a pretty big deal in South Indian classical music circles, and he's got a new live CD coming out. Varma's a singer who also plays what's called a veena, a kind of South Indian version of the sitar, only bigger. Although he doesn't like to call attention to it, Prince Varma is called Prince because he's royalty. His family once ruled the kingdom of Travancore in the southern tip of India, now known as Kerala. His great uncle was the Maharaja. The currency and stamps of the region had his picture on them, and the family was pretty rich. Sounds glamorous, but not great if you want to be a musician. Varma tells the BBC program Outlook that for families in his position, performing wasn't a thing.
We are more comfortable being patrons of the arts, to get others to sing for us, than to be a musician ourselves, which is many steps down in the social ladder, so to speak.
But there are upsides to being a royal. It can be a bit easier to throw your weight around. There's an annual festival called Navaratri that's held in honor of an Indian goddess for music and literature, but women were banned from attending. After 2 decades of demanding change, Prince Varma finally got his way.
The goddess in whose honor the festival is conducted is a woman. She sits with a book in one hand and a veena in the other hand, the instrument which I play. So I couldn't understand why in a festival in honor of a lady goddess, women were neither allowed as performers or even as listeners. They had to sit outside. So I kept saying, why not? I mean, who made this rule?
The first woman to perform was Prince Varma's teacher, Parasala Ponnamal, who just turned 90. This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, Facebook may be a private company, but this expert on technology and society believes it has public responsibilities.
There are large parts of the world where Facebook is this fundamental part of the public sphere. It's a fundamental part of social sphere. There are parts of the Middle East where large numbers of people use the Facebook as if it were the internet.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. When we think about the practice of female genital mutilation, or FGM, one thing quickly comes to mind, that it should be stopped. But my colleague at the BBC, Anne Soy, has been talking to a group of women in Kenya who support the practice. Anne Soy joins me now. And Anne, tell me about these women. I know you went to a meeting. Who was there, and what were they talking about?
Well, there were well over 1,000 women who had gathered from 8 clans of the Maasai, and they said that for many years people have been talking about female genital mutilation. No one consulted them, even when the country was coming up with laws that prohibited FGM. And so they felt that they were being discriminated against and they needed to make their voice heard. And they were coming to address the government to tell them that they wanted the practice to go on.
So these are women, they're part of the Maasai people that any visitor to Kenya often sees the Maasai people, very proud, a lot of traditions. One thing I think I just want to sort of get out there right now, it's a difficult topic, but female genital mutilation is sort of just that. You know, it's a ritual, used to be called circumcision, but we're talking about the removal of a clitoris and possibly the inner or outer labia. And this is done as a ritual to bring women in certain parts of the world to adulthood. It's a signifier, but it's deeply controversial, as is obvious just from its description. Why do these particular women, these Maasai women, support it?
Well, one, they say it's their tradition and it's been handed down to them. Generations of Maasai women have been practicing this, and so they don't see why they should stop that now. And one of the reasons they gave me is also that the men practice male circumcision and no one has a problem with that. In fact, it's being encouraged because research has shown that it is helpful to help prevent HIV/AIDS transmission. And so they say that if anyone wants to stop circumcision, it should be for both male and female. And for them, it's an important rite of passage. It marks that point when a girl stops being a girl and becomes a woman. And so anyone who's not been circumcised in their eyes is a girl and not a woman and not fit to carry out certain traditions that only women are allowed to carry out.
I mean, it's interesting, the comparison to circumcision. Of course, male circumcision is completely different and doesn't present any of the issues that female genital mutilation does. But what you touch on is an important thing. In my reading, the sort of external pressure to stop this practice is really seems to be what a lot of the Maasai and other proponents of it really reject. Let's play an audio clip of one of the Maasai activists that you met, and she's arguing for female genital mutilation.
The Swahili have a saying, a person who abandons her culture is a slave. Why do they want to make me a slave? But we believe it's easier for a circumcised woman to give birth. If an uncircumcised girl gets pregnant, she has to be cut before she gives birth, and that leaves her with scars. Otherwise, I as a mother cannot touch her. She's dirty. She won't find a husband. Even the one who impregnates her will disown her.
Now, it's an interesting comment. And as I understand it, the women who do not undergo female genital mutilation are sort of ostracized and won't get married. I'm curious whether at this meeting, were there any women who were saying, no, we have to end female genital mutilation?
Well, there was one activist who is anti-FGM, but she was quiet throughout the meeting. I tried to talk to her and she said that they had agreed that they would come and listen to the women. She's a leader in that community. And so they were just coming to listen to the women and take their issues. There had been a previous meeting of this woman where they turned violent and started attacking women who had abandoned the practice, women who are preventing their daughters from undergoing the cut. And so this was meant to sort of, you know, make a declaration to say that the Maasai women are going for it. Of course, there are a few who have abandoned the practice, but they're not regarded very highly in the community.
The female genital mutilation, it's a very tough topic to talk about, and it must be tough to report on. What's it like for you talking to these women directly?
At first, I was afraid that because I also come from an ethnic community that traditionally has practiced FGM, but the levels have really gone down. So I know from my own culture that a woman who's not been circumcised is seen as, you know, a child in front of a woman who's been circumcised. And so I thought that that was going to be a barrier because the women who've been circumcised have no respect at all for women who haven't. And so I thought it was going to be a barrier, but luckily we found women who are willing to talk to us. And of course, we're being very, very careful. We were asking the men, because it was easier to talk to them, when is the right time to approach the women to talk. And even when we went to the meeting, we stood about 100 meters away because these women were carrying sticks. They were ready for war, and anyone who looked like an intruder would face their wrath. So we kept our distance, and we had to consult with the chiefs. We had to consult with the elders to find out when was the right time to approach.
The BBC's Anne Soy in Kenya. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
I'm sure by now you've heard the latest uproar involving Facebook. Here's the sketch. The company wanted to see if the emotional reactions of its users could be contagious. So for a study, it changed the news feeds of more than 600,000 users. But Facebook didn't tell them about the changes or the study. And when people found out, many got upset. Facebook has apologized, though it insists it was within its rights. The irony, of course, is that many of us learned about the controversy on Facebook. Zeynep Tufekci is the person we turn to talk about the intersection of technology and society. She's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill.
The real question for me is the fact that a lot of people have now realized that Facebook does this every day. Our newsfeed is not some chronological, flow of our friends' posts and updates, nor is it the sort of simple, straightforward algorithm. Facebook is constantly doing these kinds of experiments to find out how to keep you, the product, on the site.
Now, I want to make sure I understand the methodology. Facebook on, again, maybe 600,000 users' news feeds, it would place things strategically and try to monitor the emotional reaction of the user. And how did they do that?
Well, it was actually a very minor tweak. I mean, to be honest, what they did was they removed some updates that contained positive words from some people, and they removed some updates that contained negative words from other feeds that were randomly decided who you got which. And then they watched you to see that in response to getting more positive updates, you also posted more positively, or in response to getting more negative updates, you also responded by posting slightly more negative updates. And it turned out to be true. It was a small effect. The tweak was small, but the results were recognizable and noticeable, so that they got published in high prestige journal.
So I'm going to go global now. Facebook does have 1 billion users around the world. Why does this matter in a global context?
Well, it matters because there are large parts of the world where Facebook is this fundamental part of the public sphere. It's a fundamental part of social sphere. There are parts of the Middle East where large numbers of people use the Facebook as if it were the internet. That's there where they get their news. That's where they do their email. And there are a lot of people who organize protests on Facebook. So you can imagine Facebook as a central part of our life in globally without an alternative. If you want to be political in Egypt or in, a lot of places, that's the only choice you have. Without an alternative, has this enormous decision-making power in what it shows you. And we have no insight into it. Why does it show me that kind of post but not the other? It's making these decisions on your behalf every day, and it's testing to find which one is going to make you come back to Facebook, which one's going to make you click on ads, which one's going to make you, sort of stay engaged to the site. And that's why globally it's so important. Facebook's not just a company that's producing widgets. It's got this huge responsibility as the social and civic space in so many countries around the world.
So Zeynep, what else have you been looking into lately?
Well, interestingly, I have been looking at how a lot of authoritarian regimes are trying to keep their supporters off Facebook and off Twitter by making them look like these awful places where, where horrible things happen.
How are they doing that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. They can't really just shut it down because, as we just talked about, it's so central to people's lives in so many countries that you can't just, unplug it. Then people get upset. What they do is they've started in many countries, we see this demonization campaign, this propaganda campaign that politicians around the world, from Putin in Russia to Indonesia, they're just saying, oh, social media, it's dangerous, it's awful. it's horrible that you have all these problems there. And so the interesting twist to this is every time Facebook or Twitter, they make a misstep or they do something with privacy that's inappropriate, or they, you know, sort of don't keep track of things, it just feeds the cycle of authoritarian regimes that want to demonize Facebook, but for the wrong reasons. So I find myself in the same day both criticizing, you know, Facebook's opaque algorithms and shaking my head at this intense campaign coming from authoritarian governments trying to demonize these platforms, which reminds me why it is so important that we have these conversations. You know, this is the stuff of life in 21st century.
Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Thanks very much, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our next story is about a monster jellyfish invasion. Scared yet? Well, you may be relieved to know that it's not a U.S. invasion. It's a fjord in Norway that has been overrun with helmet jellyfish. Jarle Mark is a professor at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim. He's been investigating the jellyfish problem. And Jarle Mark, first of all, describe what a helmet jellyfish looks like.
Well, it is like a stout jelly, big, up to 5-6 kilos in these waters. And it has short tentacles compared to most other jellies. And it's a dark red of color when you take it up.
Now, you've been in the fjord trawling for jellyfish. What did you discover?
Well, we have been monitoring an increase in the jellyfish periphylla, which is the Latin name. And it used only 7, 8, 9 years to establish a very large population, which has spread in the inner parts of the Trondheimsfjord.
How large is large? How many are we talking about?
Approximately 40,000 tons of jellyfish in the inner basin of the Trondheimsfjord.
So 40,000 tons of these helmet jellyfish. Is it the kind of thing, now I understand that they're used usually in deep water, and what one of the interesting things about this is that they're in the shallow waters of the fjord. So when you go to this fjord, is it the kind of thing where you look and you're on the shore and you can kind of see them around, or do you have to be in the water to see them?
No, these creatures, they don't like light, so they are deep dwelling. They only come to the surface at the darkest of the night.
So this doesn't seem like their natural habitat. How did they end up getting in the shallow waters? Why are they thriving there?
Well, the story of periphylla in Norwegian waters is starting in the early 70s in the fjord just north of Bergen in Norway, and it has spread from fjord to fjord.
So they're not natural to these fjords. What's bringing them in?
Well, they're not unnatural in the real sense, because they have had possibility to access these fjords. But the masses that we see now, the densities of the populations, have not been recorded any time in historical content.
So what's the problem? What problem do these jellyfish present?
Well, they are very efficient predators. The populations can grow to large, huge sizes in relatively few years. And they are efficient predators, and they eat the same food as the young stages of the commercial fishes eat. And in addition, they eat small and young stages of those competitors.
So like cod. So they've reduced cod population?
Valuable commercial species like the cod, the haddock, the whiting, the hake.
Can you swim in the fjord, or are you going to run into a jellyfish pretty quickly?
No, there's no problem. You can swim without any danger. It is not seen in the surface layers. In addition, it's not as poisonous as others jellies, which also occupy Norwegian waters in summer. But those other species, they are annual reproduction cycles, so they die in the autumn. But this periphylla jelly can be up to 30 years old, they say.
Jarle Mark is a professor at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim. He's studying the helmet jellyfish invasion in the Trondheimsfjord. Thank you so much, Jarle Mark.
My pleasure.
We've got a photo of that amazing helmet jellyfish. It's at PRI.org. And you're listening to The World on PRI. It's Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. ISIS, the Sunni militant group that seized control of a large piece of northern Iraq, is pretty good at promoting itself online. It's pumping out videos, tweets, and other messages to attract new supporters. So how's the Iraqi government responding? For one thing, it's been blocking internet access in parts of Iraq, but that's also kept Iraqis from getting online. Now, some people have been getting around that by using a smartphone messaging app called FireChat. It lets you communicate even if you don't have a signal on your cell phone or access to the internet. Misha Benoliel is CEO of Open Garden, which owns FireChat. He explained to me how it works.
With FireChat, we exploit technology called peer-to-peer mesh networking. It means that you can have a smartphone connecting directly to another smartphone, connecting to another smartphone, and basically create a group of devices that are all connected locally. So you can enable people to grow their own internet.
So the idea is you can use FireChat, but you need to use it with somebody else who also has the app.
Exactly.
So can you distinguish among those users, if anyone can use it, can you distinguish whether it's all good guys or maybe some bad guys like ISIS too?
So you have to look at FireChat like the internet. So anyone can access the internet, and FireChat is a communication tool. And we developed it to enable people to keep on communicating even if there is no internet access.
And of course, in Iraq, there is often no internet access because the government's trying to keep ISIS from using the internet. Can you tell in Iraq how people are using it?
So what happens off the grid, we actually don't know what people are saying off the grid. We have an idea of the discussion groups that were created. We have an idea when people are online, what they are talking about, because these are all public communications. There is no way to hide messages on FireChat. Everything is public. So if it's on the internet, anyone can access a chat room and chat with other people. If it is off the grid, then you can only the people nearby can access the discussion.
What's interesting is this is not what you envisioned when you created it. As I understand it, you thought the most popular user would be somebody stuck in a subway.
You're right. When we envisioned it, first we wanted to provide additional connectivity for people who have a smartphone but, for example, cannot connect to the internet or keep on chatting when they are taking the subway or when they are in festivals, like large music festival, large events where usually all the networks are congested and you cannot access the internet.
So, Misha Benoliel, personally, you mentioned you've been working on this for about 3 years. How are you feeling now? You sort of achieved this and it's out there being used in a very sort of different way than you imagine.
Oh, it's done. It's only the beginning. And we are working very, very hard to really build a new generation of mobile network that can enable information and communication to flow in places where before it couldn't flow.
Michel Benoliel, he's the CEO of the company that makes FireChat. That company is called Open Garden. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Okay, you probably know this by now, but Izzy, our World Cup predicting ocelot, was right. He predicted a win for Belgium over the USA. Those were some bitter bamboo leaves to swallow. Also tasting the bitterness of defeat is the world soccer guy William Troop. He was at the game last night in Salvador, Brazil. William, what a heartbreaker. What was it like to be there?
It was amazing and really heartbreaking, like you said, at the same time. I and at least half the stadium were yelling our throats hoarse, cheering on the U.S. till the very, very end. And, you know, when the final whistle went, it was like, you know, half the stadium was celebrating because there were a lot of Belgian fans, too. And half of us were just sitting there in our seats going, I can't believe this is over. So it was heartbreaking for sure.
So, William, I know that you are a goaltender yourself. It can be a very lonely position, but boy, the man of the hour is U.S. goaltender Tim Howard. What an amazing performance despite the loss.
Yeah, and actually, you're right. I mean, I am a goalkeeper. I've played goalkeeper all my life. And they say goalkeepers are crazy, and it's true. You got to be a little crazy for the stuff you have to do to play like Howard did. Howard had a crazy game last night. The stuff that he was stopping any other keeper any other night, you know, half of those would have gone in. Belgium would have won the game easily. It was just tremendous to see him play like that. He set a record for the most saves ever recorded by one keeper in a World Cup game.
Yeah, I think it was 16.
Night. 16, that's right. So it was like a bombardment. The Belgians kept coming at him. He kept pushing it out. It was just exhilarating for me as a keeper. And I think when I cheered the loudest during last night's game was when Howard was making saves like right on my end of the field. And I was like, yes, Howard, come on. It was really cool.
So tell us a bit about the challenges of tending goal. It seems to me as a non-soccer person like just a huge space to guard.
Yeah, I mean, basically it's all about positioning. It is a huge space. Even a big player standing in the middle of a goal is just covering a small fraction of that huge space. So it's all about, you know, where you position yourself and trying to anticipate where the ball is going to go. That's what makes great keepers great.
How do you choose which way to leap, you know, when a ball's about to be kicked?
You have to kind of read the body language of the player who's about to kick it. When you play long enough, you see someone coming towards you. You try to come out and make the angle smaller, make yourself big. And then you read the body language to see which way he's leaning. And you can kind of guess where he's going to go. You know, a good forward will make you guess the wrong way. But a lot of the time, you come out, you read the body language, and you kind of guess where it's going to go. And you go for it, and you hope for the best.
Now, the U.S. may be out of this tournament, but it really seems like it's been a huge win for soccer in the U.S. in terms of popularity and interest in this World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it really does seem that way. Here in Brazil, just seeing the number of Americans who are here to witness this World Cup in person, it's just an amazing testament to the popularity of the sport back home. And last night at the stadium, you know, it might have been 50-50 Belgians and U.S., but the Americans were cheering the loudest. When those chants of USA, USA were getting going, it was really goosebump kind of inducing. And also just being here in Brazil and seeing the coverage that the Brazilian media has given to World Cup parties and the World Cup viewing areas in cities around the U.S., I mean, it just tells you that more and more people are following the sport now.
The world soccer guy, William Troop, who is in Brazil and witnessed the tough U.S. defeat by Belgium. Thanks, William.
You're welcome. I'm still in recovery mode, by the way.
And we're going to leave you today with a track by Brazilian artist Gilberto Gil. Gil played goalie as a child growing up in Brazil, and he wrote this track, Meio de Campo, about his experiences tending goal and in homage to the 1970s Brazilian midfielder Alfonsinho. I'd say Tim Howard deserves an anthem of his own after his performance yesterday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Until tomorrow. Defendida pelo goleiro que joga na seleção e eu não sou Pelé nem nada. Se muito for eu sou dos tão prezado amigo Afonsinho. Eu continuo aqui mesmo aperfeiçoando o imperfeito, dando tempo, dando jeito, desprezando a perfeição, que a perfeição é uma meta defendida pelo goleiro que joga na seleção. E eu não sou Pelé nem nada. Se muito for eu sou dos tão fazer gol nessa partida não é fácil, meu irmão. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org. By PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. And by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.